Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. We are live. Hello to Michael Leventhal.
Hello. Hello, Mel.
And it's wonderful to have you on the show. I've been looking for you for years. You are the Chief Bean, publisher, editor, author, and most other things, of a wonderful independent publisher in the UK known as Green Bean Books. And welcome to the show. And before I forget, I'm Mel Rosenberg. I know that. I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, and I love to interview publishers. Michael, welcome to the show.
I love being called a Chief Bean, but genuinely, you're the first person that has used that phrase. I love that. I should change my business card to say Chief Bean. Thank you. I might use that.
Yeah, CBO, Chief Bean Officer. So welcome. So Michael, here's the thing. Thank you. A guy goes into a pickle store, right? And the pickles, you know, the salty pickles are too salty and the vinegar pickles are too vinegary. He's not going to set up a pickle factory. You set up a pickle factory. Tell us about Green Bean.
I think it comes from the fact that I'm too naive, or I was too naive, or I am too naive. I've been publishing books. Not children's, but I've been publishing books for more than 20 years. How many years? Almost 25 years now.
So you've been making cucumbers. You're making pickles.
Because I dumbly thought it was easy. I thought, I've got my average book is a 100,000 word history book without many illustrations. I thought, because I was an idiot, I thought, how hard can it be? 100,000 words? How hard can it be if you're doing a children's book that, you know, most illustrated books are less than 1,000 words? How hard can it be 1,000 words? I've done books that are like three volumes that are 480,000 words. I dumbly thought 1,000 words, hey, like, what is it? It's words. I've done that. I can do this. I realize now what a fool I was, because the difference is that every single word in an illustrated children's book matters. The sound of it matters. The font of it matters. The position on the page, the artwork. So my God, it's been much, much harder. But I idiotically thought 25 years, this will be easy. Falling off a log.
Yeah. So, you know, a pickle is not a cucumber.
It's not. And I often, when people send me manuscripts that are about, I don't know, how to manufacture cars, and they might be the best books, and I say, look, that's fabulous, but it's not, I can't do it in the same way that my butcher isn't going to start selling figs.
You had a great family business publishing history books and maritime books. A few words about that, and why you left it all.
Why? Well, I haven't left it all, Mel. I was a journalist for about 10 years, and then I had a very easy job interview with my father on Friday night. I'm not exaggerating, Mel. I put my CV. Do you use my resume? I put my CV in an envelope addressed to my dad and his human resources department. And he said, Friday night dinner, he said, watch this. And I said, well, I'm applying for a job with you. So it was the easiest interview I've ever had. I started working with my dad about 25 years ago. And he is what he knows about. Relative to him, you can fit what I know about publishing on the back of a postage stamp, because he's been in the business a very, very long time. He started the London Book Fair. What he doesn't know about publishing isn't worth knowing. But there was one thing he was wrong on.
Oh, one second. Is he well?
He's well. I mean, he still understands the business better than most people.
Go get him. I should be interviewing him.
Next time you can. He's not here, but next time. You can you'll speak to him. You'll learn far more from him than me.
Okay, keep going.
And I said to him, after 25 years, that's a lot of books on Napoleon, Mussolini, Stalin, Lawrence. I've done a lot of. I mean, you can see them behind me here. I've done a lot of those, and I said, look, I think there's this Jewish children's niche, and my dad thought it was an absolutely dreadful idea, and I'm delighted that finally he was wrong about something. He was wrong that it was a dreadful idea, because
I'm guessing that you had a few Jewish children of your own, and you took them to bookstores and you couldn't find them the right books, and you said, okay, I'll make my own pickle factory. I know how to make books.
As it happens, Pickles is the name of a character in a book that is coming out shortly. So I keep thinking about he's a gerbil called Pickles, but that's another story. Yeah, I'm 50 and I didn't look at children's books for 40 years because it would be weird in a way. Like, why would I? I didn't work on them. I didn't have any relatives so I didn't look at them. When I became, you know, a proud father, we were getting, you know, we've got a house packed with books. We were getting lots of Jewish children, lots of books, lots of children's books. And when I looked at the Jewish children's books relative to the general books, there are some fantastic ones out there. There are some classic Jewish children's books, but a lot of them are pretty bad, in my opinion. And, you know, the books that you and your family will love won't necessarily be the books that me and my family, you know, everyone, different tastes in food, in art, in everything. But I didn't think that the children's books that I could get in English here were good enough. The majority in English come from North America. The North American outlook, the North American sensibilities are different to the British Jewish sensibilities. So
Michael, let's make that a general statement. You know, when I go to the UK, I spend a lot of time in Waterstones, and the whole children's literature scene in the UK is different. So, you know, the Jewish scene is part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I always find it surprising that some of the most brilliant books that every family in London will have, they're not known in the States. And similarly, I get tips from friends in the States about, what do you mean you've never heard? This is like everyone has got this book. They're different worlds.
Can you give some examples? One example?
The Giving Tree was a book that I had never heard of until probably 7 or 8 years ago. I'm not even sure if it's sold here and is in print here or not. I think I got a secondhand copy, but you tell me, am I right in saying that that's a book that in the States everyone knows. Yeah, I certainly didn't have it when I was a child. I hadn't seen it till probably 7 years ago. And here I would say, I think I mentioned to someone the tiger who came to tea, and they didn't. I was astonished; they hadn't heard of it. It has sold more than a million copies. It's in 20 languages, but someone in the States had never heard of it.
There's a real cultural divide, but we can talk about that another time. So you started a children's literature publishing house.
I had an idea that there must be so many British or European Jewish writers and illustrators, and wouldn't it be wonderful to be publishing some of their work? And it would kind of equal the balance, that it wouldn't all be things coming from North America. And then I realized I had absolutely zero idea how to commission an artist or an author. Like I had no way of doing it. I know how to commission military history books on the Eastern Front and gladiators and the Battle of the Aisne and all sorts, because I know that world and I know
you needed to hire some Prussian illustrators. You failed to illustrate this book.
I genuinely had no idea how unbelievably time consuming it would be and how many vital skills and connections I didn't have. So in fact, the thing started by accident. I was in Israel with my wife and kids. I think they were both there at the time. We were just very, very, I'm not exaggerating. In fact, it happened to be Tel Aviv Book Week. We happened to go to a stall. I happened to talk to a woman who actually was the publisher and author. And I said, hey, do you have any books on Passover? And she said, well, yeah, here's one. I wrote it. And I thought, yes, this is, it was illustrated by this amazing woman, Carmel Ben-Ami. And that became the first book that I published. It was
but not written by an Englishman or an English woman.
No,
because English person.
Because when I started out, I realized eventually that it is much, 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 much easier and quicker and also cheaper to take what already exists and translate it and publish in English, because the time involved in booking an illustrator and in commissioning an illustration, a series of illustrations, I mean, that's, you're talking about a year of time. And it was, again, it really was just happy accidents. I realized that there are so many brilliant illustrators in Israel. It has one of the best children's book illustration scenes in the world. And you have, I mean, to people that are following email, David Polonsky is possibly the only Israeli illustrator that they would know, because he did the Anne Frank diary, he did Waltz with Bashir, he's done some other, you know, incredible films as well. But the second book I did was his book, The Heart-Shaped Leaf. This was published in Hebrew 15 years ago and had never been translated into English before. So you've got this, you know, I really was just the bridge between the fact that I didn't think there were enough brilliant Jewish children's books. You've got so many in Israel to choose from, so many brilliant, genuinely brilliant illustrators. Fine, so I'm just connecting the dots.
Wonderful. So up until now, I'm not going to argue with you, but I'm not going to name Israeli illustrators because I'm going to get into trouble.
Okay.
It's a good time to congratulate Dorit Magia on her new book. She illustrated my book, so. Oops, I just mentioned
the illustrations
somebody.
Are fantastic in that.
Yes, thank you. So, but this is not about me or Orit. But we have fantastic illustrators, and some of them have crossed the seas. And I hope that I'll be able to introduce you to more the next time we actually meet. It's very exciting to hear this. So, up until now, how many picture books have you done?
I've done Green Bean has done about 30, and I started out doing a couple a year. That became 5 or 6 a year. And it, originally, as I said, it was all translations. Now I'm commissioning Israeli, well, not just Israeli, I'm commissioning illustrators to take on manuscripts that I've signed up. So there's a balance. I'm still doing the translations. I'm doing brand new writers. So it's changed a little, but really, there are so many brilliant books.
So right now, because I have an audience of authors and illustrators, so you're always looking for illustrators. You're always correct. Happy to have an illustrator send you a pitch. And are you looking for authors?
Both. I will tell you two things on that. One is that I'm still only doing about 10 books every year. And a few of those are translations. A few of those are mid-grade books that have no illustrations. So it's really only kind of one or two books that I'm finding illustrators for. But I can waffle on, but on a separate point, someone asked me not long ago what I was looking for, and I didn't really know how to answer the question, but I described it as what I do when I go to my parents. I go to, you know, I'll be seeing my dad tomorrow, and I look in the fridge, and he'll say, what are you after? I say, I don't know, but I'll know when I find it. I don't really know what I'm after, but so it's very hard to say, this is the thing that I want right now. I'm looking for something that stands out to me and I think is brilliant.
But now we're going to get to the nitty gritty. You're a Jewish publisher looking for Jewish themes. So correct. No matter how good a book is, you're not going to publish it if it's about Napoleon, unless Napoleon was Jewish.
That is true at the moment, Mel. But my big kind of caveat is that's at the moment. There are a couple of things that I've seen that are so good that I'm sorely, that I may be taking those on and going beyond my niche. The problem, sorry, I say niche, I think you say niche. I can't, how do you say it in the States? I can't remember how you
say it. I don't say either.
Okay, fine. So, but once I go beyond my nice little specialist area, I'm competing against HarperCollins, Walker, Nosy Crow, and I like having my specialist area in the same way that my dad carved out military history as his specialist area, and it's a nice niche to be in. I'm sticking at the moment. I'm largely sticking with just that Jewish children's bit. That doesn't mean that they don't contain stories or moral lessons or history that won't be interesting to other people. I mean, frankly, there's pretty light Jewish content in some of them.
Michael, this is so we're looking for illustrators down the line. We're looking for good stories that you won't find in any fridge except your father's. And we're looking for Jewish themes. Does it have to be a Jewish author?
No. It's a very interesting question, and that opens the door or Pandora's box of the whole own voices debate. As it happens, within the next 2 weeks, I'm sending to the printer, it's 99% finished, I'm sending a book about Eric Weiss, who is better known as
Houdini,
Harry Houdini, Jewish, born in Hungary, changed his name as an homage to a French magician. That's a whole other story. But the book is illustrated by a fabulous Spanish artist, Laura Catalan, who is not Jewish. It's written by Judy Carpenter, who is someone I used to work with on a newspaper, who is not Jewish. So the majority of things that I am publishing are written or illustrated by someone Jewish, because people tend to write about what they know and illustrate what they know as well. And frankly, it's helpful if they have that background, if they have some background knowledge. But no, I mean, this, in fact, this is the second book I've done with this illustrator, Laura Catalan.
Yeah. You forget that you sent me the PDFs of that book.
Ah, and I did. Oh, of the Houdini book.
Yes, and it's brilliant. Okay. It's brilliant.
Good, and it folds out to, you know, yeah, 12 feet wide on both sides, so you can't even read it in one room. You have to stretch it across your landing or whatever to lay the full thing out.
So Michael, do you, like, sometimes you take books of PGA Library in the States, right?
When you say take the books, what I PGA
license them for the UK, or they take your books?
They take my books, and I will print for them.
Mm-hmm. But here you're gonna have a little reach here, because it's a brilliant story. But there's no Yiddishkeit in the story other than Harry Houdini's being Jewish.
Correct.
I applaud you for this. I mean, you know, you and I have talked about this. It's very hard to get away from these written to an audience, written about a holiday. And as authors, we often bridle when, you know, there's an opportunity. Passover is very, well, what are you going to write about? You know, the matzah who wanted to be a physician. I mean,
Mel, we've spoken about this before, and it's fascinating. The PJ Library is a incredible charity that has had I don't think that this is controversial to say, it's had a bigger impact than anything else ever has had on Jewish children's book publishing, because they are buying millions of books and sending them out in different languages around the world. And it's wonderful. It's created an industry. Suddenly someone is buying, you know, millions of pickles, so they need pickle manufacturers or growers. So that's wonderful. But, you know, as we said, there is this, it's difficult to reverse engineer creativity, to say, we're coming up to the Chagim. We need another Yom Kippur book. Let's make it. Let's have some gefilte fish in this. It's very hard to.
The gefilte fish before Yom Kippur.
Sorry.
Not necessarily during, right?
Sorry, or to break the fast, whatever your minchag is, that's fine by me.
I got it. The reverse engineering. The gefilte fish wanted to go back to being a carp.
So it's a double reverse engineering. Yep,
that's a double.
Mm. I have to tell you, I met an author a few weeks ago, and we got sucked into a ChatGPT conversation, which I hadn't played with before. And when I got home, I typed in to ChatGPT my first experiment. I said, "Write, Eric Kimmel is an author who I think is fabulous, and he is the judge on an award that I've set up for Jewish children's book writing." And I put into ChatGPT, in the style of Eric Kimmel, write a Jewish children's story, less than 1,000 words, set on Rosh Hashanah, that involves gefilte fish and has a twist at the end of the story. And lo and behold, ChatGPT spews out 800 words on a gefilte fish that comes to life. I haven't dared send it to Eric Kimmel yet, but I don't think Eric Kimmel will be very impressed with it. And certainly you couldn't publish. It's incredible what ChatGPT can do, but we've got a while of real authors before we graduate to AI.
That's brilliant. So let's now talk about your flow. How many manuscripts do you see a month, and how many would you like to see?
I'm still
there's a reason I'm asking you this question.
Sure. So I'm still publishing military history books. And what I found interesting is that although I've been doing military history books for 25 years, I probably only get two or three unsolicited submissions every month for the military history books. For the children's books, and I'm very new to, I'm wet around the ears, you know, for this, I've only been doing these children's books 6 or 7 years. I would say that every single day I get at least one submission. Now they're shorter, but every time you have a message, I like to reply to everyone personally. I like to reply to everyone, you know, within, I'll acknowledge, and then it might take me 3 to 4 weeks to actually read their submission and circulate it if I need to editors and sales. So the quantity of children's book submissions that comes through is huge, is off the charts, I would say.
When you say off the charts, it's like 50 a month?
Yes, I would say that's about right.
Okay. So here now's the point that I want to make. In the United States, for general manuscripts, a book is published, a traditionally published book, for every between 1,000 and 5,000 manuscripts. That's the ratio. So my advice to you, because you wrote to me that you spend a lot of time going over each manuscript and writing, and but if you want to find that giving tree of Yiddishkeit, you might have to go over thousands of manuscripts the way they do in the States.
Yeah, I've already had a couple of books that the manuscript was sent to me. This has happened more with the history books that I do. I've had a few books. I can even possibly, it will take too long, but I have on my shelves the books that I remember when the manuscripts landed on my desk. And within a couple of hours, I thought, this is brilliant. We don't need to do much to it. But it's very rare that happens. And I'll tell you, I don't think I've told you this before, Mel. I live in fear because of what happened to my dad it must be at least 30 years ago. My dad was sent a manuscript. My dad was publishing nonfiction, and this was fiction. And it was set in the Cold War. And it was a story about a submarine. And my dad read it and thought it was actually pretty good. But he wrote to the guy, the author, Tom, a guy called Tom. And it's like the pickled cucumber. He said to the guy, look, this is very nice. You're clearly, you're quite good. But this is not the kind of thing I do. So I'm not the right publisher. Speak to the Naval Institute Press. Speak to Kevin Epley and Sutton. Tom Sutton. Was it Tom Sutton? I can't remember. So my dad was the man who rejected The Hunt for the Red October by Tom Clancy, which sold many millions of copies. And then they did the film with Sean Connery with his terrible Russian-Scottish accent. And then it sold a few million more copies. And that's the book that my dad thought was not bad, but probably not one for him to do. So I live in fear that I'm rejecting the next Tom Clancy or the next J.K. Rowling. So I have to spend time on everything.
Wow. So how much fun is this for you, and how much work is it? Because you've also written a couple of books yourself. So is it more fun writing? Is it more fun running the business?
I think it being a writer is terrible. It's not, I have the unique kind of position of being able to write something and then publish it. So the negotiations were quite easy with myself.
You said you on Friday night, right?
I was like schizophrenic kind of. So no, I am proud of every book that I publish. I could publish triple the number of books, but I like to be personally involved with every book, and I'm proud of the books that I, I've made a few mistakes, but I'm proud of the books that I do, and I like it. Every few weeks the doorbell goes and I've got a courier delivery of the new book, and I love it. But the difference between that and I've published almost 1,000 books over 25 years, but the difference of just publishing a book and where you're thanked in the acknowledgements or my name is kind of hidden somewhere, but when you see your name on the front cover of a book, that's a real thrill. That's a real buzz. Even if no one in the world is ever going to buy the book, it's still wonderful seeing your name on the front of a book.
So show us one of your books.
I can show you. I will show you The Chocolate King in Portuguese. For me, how wonderful to see my book translated into Portuguese.
This book is about the Jewish king of chocolate.
Well, I discovered by accident that the Jewish community has been involved in the international chocolate trade for hundreds of years. It played a key role. And I thought this is a great subject for a book, because the truth is I'm a chocoholic. I eat chocolate most days of the week, you know, a little bit or a lot, you know, I'll eat a lot. And a lot of people eat chocolate. The majority of people, though, certainly in Europe, have never touched a cocoa pod in their lives, and they couldn't even tell you where chocolate, you know, we know where milk comes from. We know the process. Most people don't understand the chocolate process. And I thought, this is great. There's a great Jewish story. There's this whole idea that Christopher Columbus was Jewish or had Jewish funders, which is certainly true. He was probably the first European to taste chocolate, hot chocolate, not solid chocolate. So sorry, I'm waffling on, but yes, I wrote a book about that. And then I also published a Jewish chocolate cookbook as my lockdown ridiculous endeavor, 50 Jewish chocolate recipes from around the world. So I wrote the introduction to that, but I didn't write anything beyond that.
Yeah, but you have a cookbook that's done really well.
Yeah, it's really annoying that I've been publishing for 25 years, and then the one book that I have to reprint three times is a cookbook. Jewish Flavors of Italy is this incredible compendium of recipes. I finished the chocolate book. I sat down with a brilliant Jewish Italian cook that is a friend, and I said, never, never, never am I publishing another cookbook. I thought children's books were hard. Cookbooks are even worse. I'm never doing another cookbook as long as I live. Over my dead body will I publish another cookbook. And my friend Sylvia said, would you publish mine? And I went, yes, of course I would. I'd love to do it. So 2 years later, her cookbook is out. It's sold so well. I'm really feeling kind of stupid that I haven't done more cookbooks over the last 25 years. But they are a lot of work.
And you're also into music, and you're also into a generous philanthropy. A few words on those, please.
I'm not sure if I would say generous, but I would. that's a kind word. I have a policy that I will print one. I'm a commercial publisher. I need to cover my costs, but I will do one book a year that's for charity, where I will not make any profit whatsoever. I will cover costs of external freelancers, but I'll do at least one thing a year where all the money, all the profits, all the royalties will go to whichever charity it is. And I try and advise charities on publishing books. So many charities have the idea, or schools or hospitals, so many people come up with the idea of, a lot do cookbooks, but so many people do fundraising books, and it's really hard. It's complicated. And frankly, I've done 1,000 books. You know, I'm not a genius, but I have an idea about how the book world works. So I try and do it, but at the moment it's only one book a year, man. I'm not that generous.
Okay. But you've raised a lot of money for charity and for buying food and,
I did the first one I did was a book raising money for Parkinson's UK for a friend of mine had Parkinson's, and then the chocolate cookbook was more successful. The chocolate cookbook thus far has raised almost £20,000 for High Cancer Care, which is a cancer charity that's very close to my heart, that gave my late mum some and me some support. I'm still having support from them. So I have worked with different charities years ago. Sorry, this is like psychoanalysis, but years ago, Mel, I used to work for charities. And I remember when I was about 19 years old, my dad said to me, you don't need to work for a charity to do charitable work. You can become skilled at whatever field and then use those skills. So I got bored of working for charities, but that was one of the great bits of advice my dad gave me.
So how old are the kids now, Michael?
They are 10 and 8 years old, so they have outgrown my illustrated books, but they are narrating some of the mid-grade books that I've done.
Wonderful. So, wonderful, like, to see. So 20 years from now, one of your kids, Friday night, after kiddish, you know, and you light the candles, he puts an envelope on your table. He says, "Dad, what happens then?"
Mel, if I'm totally honest, it, like, when you present it like that, it fills my heart. You can probably see my heart jumping out of my chest. It filled my heart with joy, the idea, the excitement of that. And on our recent holiday, I stopped into a Printworks, and it was wonderful to show the kids, look, here's the paper, these massive, massive tree trunk rolls of paper. You can see the paper go all through the factory. You can see it get printed as it gets. And it was wonderful trying to inspire them. In practice, however, I know that working with family members can be very difficult. And I remember the Friday night presenting my dad with my resume, but I also remember discussing whether we were going to do a certain book on the SAS or Mossad. And my dad said no. And I said, right, well, in that case, I'm not coming for Friday night dinner. So working with families, there are ups and downs. I mean, you can trust family members. Sometimes you can trust family members more than anyone, but you can also get more aggravated by family members than anyone else. So there are pros and cons, but it would be wonderful. I would be over the moon, I think, if either of my sons wanted to join me in publishing. They have. I'm not sure if I should be proud or not, Mel, of raising these two boys, because when I say to them, look, I'm doing this new book, do you want to help? Their first question is, what royalty will you give us? Yeah. And I'm thinking, where did these capitalist kids come from? What about just doing it for love and for fun? No, we want a royalty. We want 5%. I mean, they don't have an agent yet, but they're getting there.
Oh, so now the world has gotten to know Michael Leventhal. You are a wonderful guy, and you're in a difficult business. And, authors, as you know, there are millions of people writing children's books, and very few of them get published. And I wish I had a way to help the 999 authors, some of which are splendid, who never get a publishing deal because they don't surface, they don't write on the themes that the publishers are interested in. They are not the right category of people. These are the people I would like to help. But let's get back now to you and your sage advice for us, the authors. The minnows who write picture books hoping to become the one that you choose to write an unsolicited picture book in 2025.
I've got to think on my feet or whatever, but I mean, the first thing I'll say is that there are at least a third of the submissions I get are obviously not right for me, because they're writing about pearl fishing techniques in the Azores, and anyone can, you know, it's I can immediately say, look, I don't publish this sort of book, please try, you know, just what my advice is, you walk into Waterstones or Barnes & Noble, see who's publishing that sort of book and write to that publisher. But so clearly I get the wrong submissions, and that wastes the author's time, it wastes mine. It's just there's one thing. The second thing is I'm amazed, and I'm 50 years old, and I'm not sure if times have changed, but I am astonished at how many people write to me at Green Bean Books and they spell green or bean wrong, or they spell my name wrongly. And it's not that I'm pedantic, but I think if they can't get that right, then I'm nervous. You know, a writer should be, you know, I mean, it's more important for the history books, because I think, wow, someone's writing a history of the Battle of Austerlitz and they can't get my name correct. How, you know, I can't check the
final... or they spell Austerlitz wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, that's it's almost an an automatic disqualification of someone. And every, well, not every, but most publishers have their submission guidelines. And I like it if someone writes to me and says, "Dear Michael, dear Mr. Leventhal, I've looked at your website. I bought a copy of that book. I love it. This is what I've done. You know, I'd welcome any feedback." That shows that someone hasn't sent the manuscript to 50 other people. They know what I do. They've checked. Mm-hmm. But
hang on. Is it okay to address you as Michael when people query you?
People call me, I prefer it if people call me Michael or Mr. Leventhal, because it shows they've checked. They've done a cursory check. They're not.
Okay, but there's another strange thing that I'm going to mention. And that is that on your website, you almost insist that people send manuscripts to you, which they have not shopped around at all. And why is that? Why do you care if somebody sent it to a couple of agents or publishers?
I always want to know, because I need to know if it's already on active submission elsewhere. The reason is that I am getting at least 400 manuscripts every year, and it takes me a while. You know, if someone's listening and they send me something today, and I then read it in 2 weeks, and I spend a few hours looking at something, and then I discuss it with some of my editors or, you know, sales department, and I devote time to that, and then I write back to the author and I say, "Good news, you know, I really want to do this." They say, "Oh yeah, sorry, we didn't tell you. We signed up with someone 3 weeks ago." I think, well, I don't have the time.
No, but isn't it like dating? You say, okay, I'm only going to date you if you've never been on a date before. Michael, people are submitting things all the time.
Yeah,
you might miss the Tom Clancy book.
but if I'm getting in submissions, and someone says, you know, also it's establishing trust in a relationship as well. So if someone says, "Look, it's already out with these people," then I'll still look at it, but it's not going to be my top priority to look at it, because there are other people that say, "Yeah, sure, you can look at this exclusively for a couple of weeks, and then I'm going to shop it around." Fine, I'm happy for you to do that.
What if the book has been rejected and somebody sends it to you? They've sent it to Carben or Kalaniot or PJ or Random House.
I think that's absolutely fine, because different publishers are looking for different things. But it's also part of kind of building a relationship with an author and just having an open... I'm always very open. If an author says, you know, "How many copies are you going to sell?" There's no, you know, I'll be 100% honest, because they're going to find out in due course anyway. And why not? I've seen more articles actually in the trade press that seem to kind of set authors and publishers up almost as enemies, and agents are kind of the guys in the middle trying to level the playing field. The truth is that everyone is out for the same thing, that you want to sell books. You want to sell, you know, the more books I sell, the better for my authors. So I regard us as not being in competition. You want a nice relationship with an author from the word go. You know, everyone is busy. You know, it's a hectic world. You want to work with people that you get on with. You're not getting married to someone, but
last question, because I don't know if you know Anna Olswanger.
Yes, wonderful, I do.
Wonderful agent.
Yes. I'm in touch with Anna. Yeah, I've been in touch.
So give her my love. So she was on the interview a few months ago, and she expressed her preference to work with dead people.
Well, there's a category of dead people. There's the people like Theodore Dodge that have been dead for hundreds of years and therefore don't get royalties and don't object to anything. There's also the people who died less than 75 years ago and are still in copyright, and their children or their literary estates can be fiercely protective and say, "You are not changing that word. That is the way my mother wanted that word. You are not changing that word." But so, I mean, look, jokingly, yes, the best authors are authors that have been dead for 2,000 years. But this is, look, tonight I'm going out for dinner with the author of the Houdini book. And dead authors don't tend to promote themselves very well, you know, on social media. No, I want...
So your best advice to authors is to stay healthy.
It's to stay healthy, keep doing what they're doing. And coming back to Jewish children's books, the main aim, I think, is not to educate children about a particular thing. The main aim is to engage them and enthuse them. You want children to read a book, not just once. You want them to love the book so much that for the words and the text that they're reading it again and again. You want something that's fun that children like. If it imparts a moral lesson at the same time, if it teaches them something about Rosh Hashanah, Sukkot, Tzedakah, Tikkun Olam, great. But the main aim, I want to be able to see my kids, well, now they're kind of beyond the picture, but I want them to be excited. I want them to enjoy what they're reading and them to be saying, please read it again. We love and join in. I want them to enjoy what they're doing and get excited about reading and writing as well. So
this is a great place to start to end our wonderful interview. Because in essence, you want the impossible. You want a book that has morals and yet it doesn't weigh heavy on the morals. You want a book about a Jewish holiday, but that is not necessarily about the holiday. And why am I saying the impossible? Because when you look at the incredible books of our childhood, it is impossible being brought to life. So that's essentially what we want to do, right? We want to make the impossible happen. I have to tell this terrible pun. I've been waiting for 45 minutes. Your Houdini book is magical. All right.
Thank you. I mean, the Houdini book.
No, but it really is. And I can see this as the real crossover book.
Next March will be the 150th anniversary of Houdini's birth. So I think there's going to be some excitement, but I wanted to create a book that was magical, because a seven-year-old reader, they don't know who Harry Houdini is. They don't bring anything to it. So the format of the book is magical. In fact, just today, I can't show it to you right now, but just today I got the end paper. I like to add nice flourishes. So we've got lovely end papers that has Houdini's bantam chicken called Banjo. It's just Banjo in about 60 different poses, and he's sitting behind, he's got some handcuffs and a key behind him in one. Because, you know, this is true. Houdini had a chicken that whistled when he came. So, yeah, I'm trying. Am I trying? No, I don't think I'm trying to do the impossible, Mel. That's a bit unfair. I'm open to all brilliant.
No, but Michael, I think that you should be trying to do the impossible.
I think it's, look, the clock's running. I'm sorry, I know we're out of time, but
It's okay. We're not in a dire situation. We can go on for a few minutes.
I've published 800 books about Napoleon and Hitler, and it's very refreshing to not have to do that and to think, let's do a Harry Houdini book that folds out 12 feet wide. I'm publishing this book, This Is My Shabbat, in November. It's, as far as I know, it's the first children's book, not just Jewish children's book. It's the first children's book, and every copy in the trade will have Braille throughout the book. We're printing it. Normally the charities here take a book, they rip the spine off, they splice in Braille for blind or visually impaired children, and they rebind it. And it's horrible. It's a spiral bound thing. But this story is not about someone's blindness. A child just happens to be blind. So we've got Braille, so it'll be accessible to that community. There will be thousands of books with Braille. Thousands of children and families, parents, grandparents, will feel Braille for the first time in a book. And it's kind of fun trying new impossible things and making them happen.
So that's what I was saying all along.
It's make the impossible. That can be my new strapline.
Making the impossible happen.
From the chief bean, you heard it here first.
Incredible. So, Michael, I hope that we go on and that you sprout a lot of wonderful beans.
Thank you.
Magical beans. We have to close, but I'll be in touch because this was wonderful. And so my name is Mel Rosenberg. I remember that. And I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network, which has graciously allowed me to interview the wonderful publisher, Michael Leventhal. It's been a wonderful, wonderful 49 minutes with you. So much fun. I hope the audience had such a great time. And to all of our Jewish watchers and listeners, have a very happy Jewish New Year, Shana Tova. And to everybody else, have a wonderful, wonderful. Have a wonderful, wonderful.
Mel, thank you. I very much enjoyed the conversation. Thank you. I hope I've answered the questions, but thank you. I've enjoyed that. Many conversations.
Michael, you don't have to answer all the questions. I can have you on again next year.
Fine. Okay. We'll make it a date.
If they don't fire me.
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
From London to your shores.
Goodbye.